Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio, Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on this Tuesday edition, how feasible is a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico? We've got a report about that. Also, when protest becomes a laugh riot, that's a write-up that Grant's got for us. The Economist compares Trump to King Henry VIII. And cancer, believed to be related to a common product that you may have used. That and more information coming up on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. It's a growing audience. And also email us comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate those. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo here today. This first note is a sports note. Grant, you'll have some feelings about this. When it comes to the sporting adventures, our good friend Zaza Pachulia from the Golden State Warriors. If listeners are not following the NBA all that closely, Zaza is, well, it's an interesting name for one. Reminds me of pizza, Zaza. he's a big guy, about a 7-footer, huge guy. He's not super skilled, but he's kind of the equivalent of the hockey goon, where he comes out and he'll put a body on you, let you know that he's there. Spurs' best player, Kawhi Leonard, went up for a shot. Zaza ran underneath him, and Kawhi steps on his foot, sprains his ankle pretty bad, and is out for a while. The raging debate on the sports world, did he do it on purpose? Did he step underneath him on purpose? Thoughts?
It's hard to say he did it on purpose because Zaza wasn't looking at the ground as he ran sort of past and through Kawhi Leonard, so it's not like he knew exactly where his foot would be so that Kawhi Leonard would come down and land on it. But at the same time, it's extremely careless. When you go up to challenge a shooter's shot, you're not supposed to be running into his landing space like that. And it was almost like he was trying to charge into the front row of spectators. That's not really the most careful sportsmanlike way to challenge a shot.
A lot of players are doing that, and I don't like it. If you can't get there to block the shot clean, you're late.
Yeah.
Don't run into the guy. Don't come underneath where he's landing. And I've heard what people have said. They've said the similar thing to that, where he wasn't looking. To me, I don't think it matters. Mm-hmm. As long as you know where the guy's body is, you know his legs are on the bottom of that. I can look at a guy, run at him, and turn my head at the end, and I know roughly I'll be underneath him. Mm-hmm. So that's what Shaq said, too, by the way.
Right.
And you got to listen to Shaq when he says something.
He has a lot of authority there.
He does.
So I'm sure he's probably done it a few times.
Anyway, it's good drama for the NBA because the Golden State's not really very well liked outside of San Francisco area. They've had fans, I'm sure, in a lot of places. But with Durant going there, they're kind of the villain. And then you got this Zaza, the modern-day Bill Laimbeer. So,
unless we forget about Draymond Green. He's also on that team.
And Draymond Green, too. So there's quite a bit of back and forth there. But anyway, it's interesting to see. I hate watching those replays, though, because I've sprained my ankle fairly badly in basketball. And I hate to see it turn like that, and they keep showing it over and over again. I'm like, can't look at this thing anymore. Just makes me hurt looking at it.
Yeah, definitely he was not being careful to avoid any contact, so he might not have known the precise location of where Kawhi Leonard was going to land, but he definitely would not have been upset, it seemed like, if Kawhi got hurt on that play. So that's where it was dirty, because he was just so extremely careless that it was almost intentionally careless.
Popovich was not happy. Coach Pop, he was very upset. So anyway, kind of an interesting story there. He, by the way, Zaza Pachulia, if you haven't seen him, I think he is one of the biggest heads I have ever seen. it's a huge head.
It's like an Easter egg statue, or Easter Island statue.
Yeah,
yeah, he's a giant, giant individual. So it's one of the biggest heads I've ever seen.
He looked like he might have that. What's that called? Gigantitis or something?
Oh, yeah.
Where you have that deformity or something where you're just too big in certain parts of your body.
Right, because a lot of times when guys are real tall, they're kind of thin or they're kind of, you know, but he's just like a solid shape. Right. It's like a giant rectangle, a huge head. We've talked recently about some of the dangers of too much caffeine, especially for young people. That's killed a guy. This is from thestate.com. Too much caffeine caused Spring Hill student's death. 16-year-old Spring Hill High School student collapsed in a classroom last month, and he died, they say, from ingesting too much caffeine, according to the county coroner. It's the official cause of death for the young fellow. Caffeine-induced cardiac event caused a probable arrhythmia. Didn't have any problems before this. So what did he drink? He drank a large diet Mountain Dew, a cafe latte from McDonald's, and an energy drink over the course of about 2 hours. Those are pretty common drinks. He drank them quick, went to class, had a heart attack, and died, 16 years old.
Yeah, that's, well, those are probably some of the three worst things you can, not ripping on McDonald's or anything. But
it's very potent, caffeine-wise, yeah.
Well, yeah, Mountain Dew, which basically dissolves anything you put in it, and then you have this coffee,
a latte, which is going to have the shots in it of espresso, so it's even higher. Yeah,
and then you have the energy drink. So,
and they didn't name the energy drink. They didn't want to like throw anybody under the bus, but he drank an energy drink. I don't know which one it was.
Yeah, so it's just a bad combination. Even if he didn't die from it, it ruins your health, even if you don't have a really serious event from it. But yeah, you just have to... not mix certain things together, I guess.
Well, it is surprising because I think most people, especially young people, when you're feeling pretty good, you think, oh, I can handle that. You know, it's not a big deal. I can drink those things. And maybe most people could, but in this case, he couldn't. So those, what really surprised me about it was that those are three pretty basic drinks. You wouldn't think much of seeing somebody drinking that because it's very common. He drank them quickly within a short period of time, and I don't know what else he had going on. They say he didn't have a medical problem before that, but in any event, it killed him. So that's a real, real shocker. You have to be careful with those drinks, particularly those energy drinks, too. That's like pretty strong. Related to that health note, health agency says that this chemical called glyphosate is probably carcinogenic. What is that in? It's in Roundup, the weed killer from Monsanto. 800 cancer patients are suing Monsanto. The maker of Roundup claiming the company failed to warn consumers about the risk of cancer associated with Roundup products. Monsanto, of course, says, now we've got reports saying it's fine, but there's some other reports saying we think it's probably the cause of cancer.
Is it really that surprising, though, when if you're anywhere near that Roundup spray, it's almost like you can hardly breathe at all? It's like, yeah, it kills weeds, but it probably could have a pretty devastating impact on a lot of other living things too.
There's a lot of chemicals that you may smell over, you know, just the course of your day. Weed killer. My neighbor had something done to their driveway with asphalt. It and your nose tells you, I want to get away from this. It smells terrible. This is not good. Probably. I don't know all the implications of all of it. But when I smell something like that, my first thought is I want to get away from this. It's your body's warning you to leave.
Yeah, well, I think any chemical is harmful to the body in some, either in a very minor way or not, but it's just not natural, and you shouldn't be ingesting it, however it's done through smelling it, or maybe it gets on your skin, or however that Roundup can affect someone. But yeah, you have to be really careful. Just, you never know what you can touch and your body, you don't know how your body will react to it, so it's... yeah, it's literally a minefield out there because especially as people, they're turning to the chemicals to fix like lawn issues or whatever it might be instead of maybe the longer term, harder work method of just doing certain things.
One of the ladies, the one that's the focus of this particular write-up, she used it for 5 years and they have a coffee farm. So they were using a lot. So they, you know, it wasn't just, they didn't just spray their driveway once or something. It was an ongoing thing. So anyway, it's something to think about. I know different people would use that. A lot of people get services that come out and spray things. That happens pretty often in my neighborhood, and I don't just because, well, a couple of reasons. One, I don't want to pay for it. Number two, we have wells. And so I just always think, well, whatever I put on the top's going to the bottom, and I don't want to, and I'm no expert in that, so maybe somebody thinks that would be crazy, but I don't know. I just assume that it will somehow get down into the water, so I want to be careful with it. But you know what I always notice is that all the birds and the wildlife, they're always on my yard and not the neighbors, at least at that time period, because they don't want to be by those chemicals either. And you can, they smell terrible.
Yeah, well, like in my yard, I have no need to spray it because there's no grass. The weed, the weeds are the yard. That's what makes it look green, so I keep them there. And they're a lot easier to tend to than grass, so there's actually some natural advantages to it.
Yeah, that's true. If you don't have, well, you know, in Oklahoma here, when it dries out in the late summer, you know, you don't have to hardly mow your lawn because unless you're watering it all the time, because the sun takes care of it, the weeds and the actual grass. One of the big things that the Trump administration talked about, or President Trump talked about when he was a candidate, was building this border wall between the United States and Mexico. There are some ideas about that. Is it practical? Can you do it? There is a new proposal from a group. This is from Business Insider. A group of architects submitted this proposal for Trump's border wall. It's a one-way sheet of plexiglass. You know, like when you go to the store and you look and you know it's an office and you can't see into it, but they can see you. Sort of a safety feature there for the store. Well, that's what they're proposing. Penna Group, a construction firm in Fort Worth, Texas, is one company vying to build the wall, which would be a big score, right? But that would be risky, too, building down there. But it's not proposing a standard concrete fixture. The company submitted a design for the wall made of wire and plexiglass that would work similar to one-way mirror. The U.S. would be able to see through while Mexico side would not. So they'd be looking at themselves.
That's actually really, really smart because you have people, obviously, they try to sneak across a lot of the time, especially by cover of night. And if they didn't realize that they were being watched the entire way right behind the wall, they probably wouldn't be so willing to try something like that.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I don't know if it's doable. You know, that's the question. And that leads into this write-up from Time. Barriers to a border wall, and they've got some issues that may come up. I think Time doesn't want it.
Right.
So you got to factor that in as well. But this is what they say. Although the latest spending bill did not include funds for it, President Donald Trump is not backing down from his pledge to build a nearly 2,000-mile wall along the Mexican border. Designs are being solicited, and construction of prototype barriers is scheduled to begin in San Diego this summer. But fulfilling Trump's signature campaign promise won't be easy. Mexico says it won't pay. Democrats are opposed, and even GOP allies suggest a wall spanning a full border is unrealistic. They say here are some other challenges facing the project. Different parts of the landscape could be a bit of an issue. They say in San Diego County, there's 14 miles of multi-layer fencing, plus cameras and lights, but people can still scramble across under the blankets of fog common to the area. So I guess that's because there's certain areas where there's not a wall. I don't. What else are they doing? But anyway, because of the fog, they're saying they shoot through. It seems to me like if you just built more wall, that would solve it. But
right.
Maybe I'm missing something.
Yeah, I'm not sure what kind of wall it is. If it's a fence, I'm sure they can climb it.
Yeah.
Or you can cut through it too. So if it's not concrete, there's always ways to get through a wall. If it's not electrified or something like that.
There's a deadly terrain in certain areas. They say barriers and patrols in cities have funneled migrants to the Sonoran Desert. While some make it across the waterless expanse on foot, thousands have perished. So that's, I don't know why that would even be an issue for building a wall. It sounds like it's a bad way to go anyway. And there's some sight line issues in places. They say some existing fence segments obscure views. Before landing mat panels were replaced in Nogales, agents couldn't see the smugglers coming or the rocks sometimes thrown. And so they have a few different issues there, they think. There's rivers in different places. They say it would disturb wildlife. I don't know that's a major issue for too many people. But land rights, yeah. Anyway, I don't know. It's interesting. But if you look at the number that come across in San Diego, it's 97,000. And this is 2013 through 15. 53,000 came through Calexico, which is right there, right off of Baja. 19,000 came through Yuma. 393,000 came through Arizona, that whole expanse there. 61,000 through New Mexico. 9,000 through Texas, which is less than I would have thought. 51,000 through Well, no, I take that back. Different parts of Texas. Altogether, it's quite a bit. Well, almost about 700,000 altogether. So, anyway, they say there are some things that are maybe in the way. I think the biggest thing that's in the way is just people coming together and agreeing on a solution and then getting it done.
Yeah, well, I think if you look at what other people have tried for these sorts of things, usually deserts are a natural barrier that prevent people from going across it because it is such a difficult terrain. So most countries have some kind of buffer zone they use, a desert or a mountain range or something like that. In this case, there is some of that, but it's not. There isn't really a natural barrier that can't be easily traversed between Mexico and America. So you need to build a wall. In Iraq, the way America stopped foreign fighters from coming into Iraq was by building a wall. And there's only one way in or out. And American Marines were there and they could check everyone. So Hadrian built a wall to keep the Scots out in, or to keep the Scots in Scotland. And then you had the Great Wall in China, which didn't work that well in that case. But so it's been tried before. And most of the times it's pretty successful. And I mean, and all the arguments against it, I mean, there has to be something done. You're having that's close to 1 million people mm-hmm. in 2 years coming to this country illegally. And I mean, some of those people need help, and maybe there could be some better immigration services or maybe some better ways for people to come into the country legally. But nonetheless, if you have 1 million people coming every 2 years into your country, it's going to destroy it. I mean, even if the people are good-intentioned or well-intentioned, it doesn't matter. It's still going to disrupt everything.
1,991 miles, that's how long it has to be. So that, to give you an idea of that, that's 9 times the distance from Earth to the International Space Station. So, yeah, it's a lot of fence. If, you know, I imagine engineers are really racking their brains because if you can land the deal, you're going to do all right for yourself. And they're doing prototypes right now to see what'll work and what won't work. So if you get any ideas, think about them. Send them in to somebody.
No, I would do. I just build a huge ditch, like a moat.
Uh-huh.
And if people want to get across it, they have. Then on the other side, you don't need like a huge wall. You just need people there, and they have to cross the ditch to get over.
Huh.
And
natural barrier.
Yeah, if you make it wide enough, then they have to walk or cars can't go in it because it's too steep or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That might at least make give Border Patrol time to get there.
That would probably make a lot of people nervous because when you dig down to make the trench, you actually uncover all their tunnels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Flood all the tunnels that they've got coming across. So it's one of those ongoing issues. It is a lot of border area to try to cover. And, of course, there's different, you know, people have different thoughts about it one way or the other. But, again, something does need to probably be done there.
Time just sounds so desperate there, trying to say that we have wildlife concerns that just build a wall. It's only America that gets accused of racism for trying to build a wall or protect its border in any way, and we have all these politicians who basically see the illegal immigrants as objects for their own purposes, whether for cheap labor or for voting purposes. It's not about altruism or compassion, and so we need to try to get rid of that myth.
Yeah, well, it's a PR campaign, but it's a very hard one to win in the current climate. Key David program's coming up here in a bit on KPCG, also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host Stephen Fleury, and also thetrumpet.com today. Check out the top story, the German Army, a risk for German security. Related to that, German Army back on German streets for the first time since World War II. And he was right, the hidden Nazi underground. Those are the top stories and related stories there at thetrumpet.com today. Grant, you've got a good write-up for us from the Washington Times. It's not the Washington Times, but it's the Washington Post. I saw a headline today where they were shouting for joy when there was some bad coverage of the current president.
Right.
They erupted into applause.
Wow.
That people have abandoned even the illusion of fairness.
Mm-hmm.
It's outrageous. Anyway, Washington Times, this
yeah.
one. When protest becomes a laugh riot. I like a laugh riot.
Yes, definitely. This is talking about basically radical left protesters who get more and more angry that apparently their protesting is not swaying many minds to their ideas. Then they get violent. But it seems like the government has been really cracking down hard on a lot of these people. There was a woman in a pink Lady Liberty costume who I think she laughed derisively at some sort of government event, and she might be facing a year of jail time. And then a couple other guys dressed in Ku Klux Klan outfits, I think protesting the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, because apparently he's in the Ku Klux Klan,
right?
If that is to be believed. But they didn't even say anything, but they're also facing a year of jail time. And it's kind of nice to finally have people who are trying to overthrow the government at least being punished a little bit.
Yeah, well, there is the right to protest, but again, it gets just to be obnoxious. You know, it's one thing to have a protest; another thing to just be getting out of hand, really. And you know, there's some headlines today even about how it is becoming in some of these situations more violent and more threatening, obviously towards conservatives, for the most part. And you know, threats at town hall meetings and things like that. I mean, people got to, you know, just calm down for a second, because some of it's getting out of hand. So at least in some cases, I don't know if these people would actually see any jail time, but maybe it's at least a deterrence from going and just being ridiculous. And you'd have to be careful with, you know, what you're protesting, because if you show up in some sort of a costume, people may not know that you're protesting. Right. They might think you're supporting it. So you never know, you know, which way it's going.
Yeah, either way, those guys in the KKK outfits are putting themselves at huge risk.
Bad decision. Bad decision.
Really is not wise. Maybe a year of jail time is best for them. That's the best possible outcome there.
Yeah, you'd be like, no, we're against it, you know. But
oh, that makes a lot of sense that you're right. Dressed up as them.
Right. But you got to make sure people get the protest. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of, obviously we've heard about a lot of speakers that trying to go to the University of California, Berkeley, and getting shut down. And in a lot of those cases, nothing is happening. Hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage being inflicted by people who have just totally lost any ability to think for themselves. They're just taking whatever they're told and going out and being violent thugs. And they're not even getting arrested. The police are basically standing down. But in this case, it seemed like definitely a lot less violence was being committed, and yet maybe they're trying to finally start cracking down on a little bit of this and maybe just saying, stop disrupting the whole system. That's not what needs to be done here.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because you do like the freedom to be able to protest certain things, but then if it gets too far, and which is a tough line. Like, mm-hmm. where do you draw the line on those types of things? But it is interesting. I can imagine the judges are not happy. They don't want to sit there with their day going through one after another. You know, it's like going to traffic court or something. Yeah. You know, next, come on up. What'd you do? And pay the fine or whatever, or maybe do face some sort of time there. But I would imagine in most cases the judges are fairly liberal anyway, and so mm-hmm. they would probably just slap on the wrist. But it's something, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess the whole point of this article is not even so much that there's going to be more punishment, but just the fact that they're raising their voices to just the level of hysteria, because they think that somehow if they go more extreme, they'll convince some people that they're right. Even, I think it was about a week ago, some Israeli Defense Forces veterans were visiting the University of California, Irvine, and they were answering some questions there and trying to dispel some of the hatred that is taught on a lot of American campuses. But then about 40 pro-Palestinian students came in, and they started yelling vulgarities at the soldiers there. It's pretty obvious who is being hateful in a lot of those situations, but yet they're still allowed to do it. They're still allowed to disrupt, and I don't think that's really even the point of a protest. You're not allowed to legally, for example, block roads, and yet that is happening all the time now. People are breaking the laws just so that they can protest, but then it's ruining everyone else's day.
Yeah, it's not a matter of them having a open dialogue about facts and trying to come to the truth of an issue. It's about coming with a certain perspective and then just throwing a temper tantrum. And then if people don't give you your way, you just continue with the more extreme temper tantrum, which you see all the time. If you go to the store or something and you see a little kid that's maybe a little on the edge, if it's not dealt with, well, they just keep on getting more, you know, wild until either it's stopped or they get what they want. And mm-hmm. I think it's the same thing here. It's really interesting, because these types of protests have nothing to do with facts or truth. It's a wild emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, how do you, I think we all know that if you're trying to talk to somebody and you're trying to come to some sort of agreement and there's just a wildly emotional individual you're dealing with, good luck. You're not going to get anywhere.
And the thing with this here is that a lot of this wild emotion and these crybaby type protests are being conducted at the worst possible time. There's a poll here that says that only about 20% of Americans right now actually trust the government to do what's right for them all or most of the time. And that's even with the recent change in administration. So it doesn't even matter which party's in control. It seems like, though, the protesters, if they would just stay quiet, people would get upset at the government all on their own. But when you're forced to pick between the Trump administration and these lunatics who are crying and screaming and rolling around and burning cities, it's really not too hard to pick.
It's interesting. The protests and so forth have not died down much. I guess maybe I haven't seen any big large scale ones, but the media is fueling it, and you see some people out there doing some things.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually like a laugh riot, but now after you describe it, now I don't like the laugh riot anymore.
Yeah, the maybe their costumes are funny and their antics are funny until they get a little bit too carried away and start hurting people.
Yeah, it can get pretty interesting. And there's all sorts of there's just all sorts of movements people are behind and supporting. Just trying to think all the different ones. They all kind of come back, I guess, at the end of the day to sort of a liberal versus conservative, and then there's different arguments within that.
Right.
But that is sort of what we're seeing today. So pretty interesting. That's from the Washington Times. That was just a look at some of these protests and where they're going. And I guess it seems like they're going to keep going that way, more extreme.
Right. And I mean, it even got to the point where there were, I think, 212 felony charges just in the District of Columbia over some recent protests. So they're obviously going way past the bounds of law and order to try and get their point across. And finally, law enforcement is being allowed to do their job to stop some of it, it seems like.
There's a town that was going to vote to disband their police force, and I saw today that they decided not to do that.
Well, that's smart.
They wised up and realized, you know what? We're actually going to need those guys to keep law and order. So really just interesting. And kind of on a related note to that, apparently Marvel's making money hand over fist in all these superhero movies and everything. And they tried to do a Black Lives Matter comic book or something.
Comic strip, I think.
Comic strip, that didn't take. So
yeah.
That was maybe that was maybe a little too hot button of a topic to make a comic strip about. So that didn't work.
Yeah. Speaking of those Black Lives Matter protesters, there was that instance a while back where I think a guy was getting his car broken into and his things stolen out of it, and so he went up to the police officer and said, "Well, why didn't you stop this from happening?" And it's pretty ironic that someone who protests against the police is now relying on the police to enforce the law.
Right. Yeah. Don't like you until I need you, and then they come on and do your job. You know, keep me safe. Yeah. Really interesting times we're living in. That's from the Washington Times, when protest becomes a laugh riot. Grant, thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
Listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. And we're online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, we'd appreciate that. At KPCGFM, and you can email us comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo here today. We were talking earlier about the caffeine difficulty and then the chemicals in Roundup that might have some problems. All kinds of substances, and they get more dangerous and more deadly. This is from the Huffington Post. Officer overdoses on fentanyl just by brushing it off his shirt. Fentanyl is an extremely powerful drug, and there was a drug stop, a traffic stop. They found the drugs, and they always put on gloves to be very careful. He took his gloves off and didn't realize that he had a bare hand, and one of the other officers said, "You got some of that on your shirt," and he brushed it off, and he almost overdosed. He almost died just from touching it. That tells you how powerful fentanyl is.
Yeah, well, I mean, if anyone's thinking of trying that drug, I mean, any drug, it's so easy to take too much and just to get over your head and ruin your life just in one small instance. So, it's just crazy that people pay money for that and that they they even try to take it and get like a high from it or whatever
yeah,
it does.
It's outrageous. They say fentanyl is synthetic opioid is 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine. Wowee. And it can enter a person's body through inhalation and through skin contact. And that's from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So just touched it inadvertently and it almost killed the guy. And people want to purchase that. But, you know, again, that speaks to the power of addiction. And so the officers are dealing with that all the time. It was just a traffic stop, and the people had it all over their car. I guess they probably were trying to get rid of it, and it fell about or whatever. And so a lot of times you'll see them out there with gloves on and things, I guess. And, you know, you think, well, what's the big deal? But I didn't realize how deadly these substances are, just even to touch them.
Yeah, it's it just, as time goes on, I think people who sell and make drugs, they keep having to go to more extremes, because when you become addicted, you have to keep finding the next high. Because apparently from the research they've done, the first high you get from a drug is the best. Or like, if I can call that the best. And then afterwards, you're always trying to get that, but you can never get it back.
Yep.
And so that's why people move to more and more extreme drugs. I don't know what will come after fentanyl. Because that will just kill you if they make something more potent than that.
Well, what's really interesting about that is I saw a local news story. I don't know if it was about that particular drug, but something like that. And they said, you know, there is a brief period of time when they come up with something new and it's not illegal yet because they haven't made the law for it. The law is behind the criminals in that sense.
Right.
Now, I'm sure you'd be in trouble of some kind. I don't think it's a freebie. But every time they find something, they're like, well, this is new. We don't actually have a law against this. And then they've got to make the law. So it's just this continual race sort of to come up with something more extreme. And then the lawmakers are trying to outlaw it. So there's a weird sort of gap between those two.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And it shows lawmakers how important they are, that they stay on top and that they communicate with the law enforcement so they can... Because the law enforcement can only do what the law tells them to, because they're enforcing the law. So we have to make sure the lawmakers have the right information, that we empower them to make those good laws, and so that the police can protect people from these just dangerous drugs.
Yeah, terrible situation there. You've got a write-up here, Abraham, the headline is NHS cyber attack. This was a big attack that just occurred recently. Man who accidentally saved the world from the hack failed his IT GCSE, which I guess would be the testing that they need. I'm not familiar with what it stands for, but he failed it. So he was a failure, but it turns out he saved the world.
Yeah, this is a kind of a neat story, because the WannaCry virus, as it spread around the world and ransomware and all that, I guess this man, Marcus Hutchins, he's the one who accidentally discovered a kill switch that helped shut down the virus as it was spreading. And this Marcus Hutchins, he doesn't have his most basic IT qualifications. He never finished school to get his IT degree. But he did it all with all that, and he became the hero that stopped the virus from spreading.
Right. He, from what I could see, he was in school for it. So, I mean, he's obviously quite bright and he understands a lot of it.
Yeah.
But the school's network went down and they accused him of taking it down. He claimed he didn't. And so he got kicked out because of that.
Yeah.
And so that stalled his schooling career because they thought he hacked the system.
Yeah. They accused him of a hacker. And so he had to, he was, banned, and he couldn't use a computer anymore. He had to do everything on pen and paper, so he didn't pass his degree to get IT certification. And so he just forgot. He said, "Forget school. I'm just gonna go do this the other way." So he's working with a U.S. security firm in his parents' house, in a room in his parents' house. That's where he works from. His main work is saving hospitals from the virus, because apparently from what I read, especially in Great Britain, the hospital and the health system in England still runs off of Windows XP. So they're running off of an outdated system that does not have security protection updates anymore, because Microsoft pulled those updates a while ago. So all the data from the healthcare system in Britain is on XP. And so his job was to always monitor that, make sure people weren't trying to steal health records or something like that. And so when he was doing this, he from the room in a parent's house, he found the kill switch and he actually stopped it from basically taking over the whole system there. And he said, I'm definitely not a hero. I'm just someone doing my bit to stop botnets.
Right. It's just funny. Yeah. I mean, I suppose that's every kind of like computer, young computer person's dream, hanging out in their bedroom in their parents' house and doing all these things, saving the world. But it's kind of an interesting picture. You can think about it as like mom, you know, telling him, hey, lunch is ready. And he's like, well, hang on a sec here. I'm trying to save some hospitals in Britain. So it sounds like some sort of an odd superhero that never quite made it out of the house.
Yeah. Yeah, the accidental superhero.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an interesting thing about people like this because they can work in their pajamas if they want from a computer at their house. But yet they're doing very high level work. But it's not what we typically think of those people.
Yeah,
but
we have to come to work here in our pajamas, so that's a little different.
Yeah.
Staying at home.
Yeah, we actually have to drive all the way. But but yeah, it's just really interesting that, and I think it's despite it was a bad accusation against him, he didn't hack the school he was in. But I think it's a good story about perseverance too, that despite things not working out and maybe a bit of in an unfair way, he still persevered and he did get the training and education he needed, just not through a degree. He did it all through workplace experience.
Yeah, and you can read about a lot of people that do that where they're not, you know, it didn't all work out exactly like they were hoping, but they still persevered and became successful. But the thing about somebody like this fellow or other people like that, though, is that they are pretty bright. I mean, they are good at what they do, and they took an unconventional route for one reason or another, but they did have the capacity to do the job and do it pretty well. Because, you know, anytime I've read a few books about, you know, successful people and even one where they did a lot of surveys of successful people, and a lot of them, you know, weren't the head of the class necessarily. But, of course, that doesn't mean that it's good to do poorly. You know, that's the other side of it, where somebody can be like, ah, I don't care, I'm not going to try, and I'll be this big success. And that's not the case. It's just that in some cases people had a real specialty in an area and they weren't as good in the other areas. But that didn't mean they were a failure. They just really went after that area that they had an aptitude in. So it's not like this guy's a, you know, I was going to say a hack, but that would be a poor choice of words. Yeah. He obviously is quite good at what he does. He just went an unconventional, took an unconventional route to get where he is today.
Yeah, he's not someone who just was sitting around waiting for the job to come to him. He worked hard, and he obviously had some education in it, and he job experience, and he was working towards it. He had a lot of work ethic, and he's just good at what he did anyway. Otherwise, he wouldn't have got hired without the degree. So you can't. It's hard to replicate this because each, like with all the successful people, they are somewhat unique, and the circumstances in which they did are unique, and so we can't always replicate it or think that we're the next great billionaire because we didn't graduate school. Well, that's not usually the case. But in any event, even if you don't do well in school, or maybe you have a passion for something, eventually someday you might become an accidental hero like Marcus Hutchins became.
I wonder if he probably doesn't get paid anything for his saving the world there.
Probably not.
He gets his name out there, and I'm sure that'll help him down the road where more people say, oh yeah, that's right, you were the guy that did that, and clearly he would be looked at for certain jobs probably. So it'll probably help him. You would like to see him get some sort of reward for his help.
Yeah.
But again, it's almost like what we were talking about with, say, a new illegal substance coming out and then a new law. It's the same sort of thing here where you have people coming out with new ways to try to hack computers and steal information, and then you've got people on the other side trying to keep up with them and then figure out how to stop what they're doing. It's this constant good versus evil, I guess, battle that rages like in every sector of society, it seems like.
Yeah, it's interesting in the computer world because it's all done with ones and zeros in code, and you never really, you don't see the other person you're trying to stop or get the better of. It's just all done through the digital world. So it is interesting that no matter what aspect of human life and behavior we look at, there's always someone trying to use it to their selfish advantage and hurting other people, and there's other people trying to stop them. And that's true in any segment of behavior.
I guess if you enter a computer contest of some kind, you either come in number one or you're a zero.
Yeah.
That would be the, thank you.
Yeah, that'd be the appropriate code.
The appropriate code for that. What place did you take? You're either a first or a zero. The Wall Street Journal reported late Monday evening that Ford plans to cut about 10% of its worldwide workforce. That's not good. Which comes to about 20,000 jobs. The paper cited people familiar with the proposal. I guess some of the shareholders weren't happy. They didn't meet their sales goals, and they want to cut some of their expenses. So they're thinking forward. It's thinking about cutting 10% of its worldwide workforce, 20,000 jobs. Usually pretty good paying jobs, too, and hard to go get another one. I would think. I don't know. You'd have to go to a different automaker or something. I mean, I don't know if those skills translate. I'm not sure what jobs these are exactly. But so anyway, we've had interesting headlines about the economy doing better in some ways. I saw today that the housing is selling. The houses are selling almost at pre-bust levels, at the height of the boom before 2008-ish, I guess. So houses are selling. Some things are up, but some things aren't up either. And cars are always an interesting thing because, you know, for them to stay making money, you have to buy new cars all the time. But you hope when you buy a car, it'll last you 10 years, you know. So, but yeah. They just keep selling them and selling them and selling them, or trying to. And I bought a car years ago, and it's, I don't know how old it is now, probably 5-6 years. And but I keep, now I get keep getting stuff from the dealership. They want me, I'll trade it back in. We'll get you a new one, you know. I'm like, but I have to pay more money, right? Yes, of course. So there you go. They try to make it seem like it's a real good deal for you, and you know, oh, we need these used cars and all that. So anyway, they want to sell. They got to sell. And you think about all the manufacturing people, the people at the dealerships, the salespeople. There's a lot tied into that auto industry, all predicated on us buying cars all the time.
Yeah, the car industry is interesting because it's all, today it's mainly predicated on credit. That at some point you can get enough credit to you can buy a new car, you can trade in your other one. Instead of maybe buying one that lasts you most of your lifetime or half your lifetime, whatever it might be. And so a lot of it is based off of going to debt as well. You get a loan and that's how most people can buy cars. Very few buy them in cash, I think. So the problem with car dealers is it just makes America's debt problem worse and worse when they're successful because more people are going to debt, buying the cars or trading them in or who knows what. So
yeah, you don't see too many people come with a briefcase full of cash.
Yeah.
Just present it to them. Here you go. Obviously you wouldn't do it that way. I'm sure you'd write them a check or something. But yeah, you don't see a lot of that. It's all about the payment. You know, what's the monthly payment going to be and the interest rates and so forth. And I think they've been able to move, I would think, a little more because the interest rates have been so low to where you're hardly paying anything on interest. But you know, that it doesn't last forever. And like you said, it is a world predicated on debt. So that's interesting report there from the Wall Street Journal about Ford planning to cut 20,000 jobs. And, of course, retail is just struggling. Even TJ Maxx is struggling now, which, of course, is sells things at a little bit of a discounted price. And the next big, they don't know what they're going to do with the malls because the malls are shutting, are going to be really having a hard time. Stores are going out of business. Nobody wants to come in there. Some people are talking about turning malls into data centers
right,
to use the space. But the American mall, as we know, it's probably going to be a thing of the past pretty soon.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about because as a kid, it's a special treat to go to a mall because there's all the stores and stuff you don't normally see when you're shopping with your mother. So so it is kind of a unique thing, I think, in our modern society.
What are the teens going to do?
Yeah, I know.
Virtual reality malls.
Probably. So they'll probably make a video game where you just go shopping in a mall.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, they already have that.
That's called Amazon.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, anyway, the economy's doing different things. Kind of interesting. You've got one more write-up for us today. This is from PRI.com. An economist reporter dishes on Trump's priming the pump interview. The economist compares Trump to King Henry VIII.
Yeah, this PRI.com, they do an interview with the person who wrote the Economist article. Mm-hmm. And the Economist article is really interesting. And I'm just going to focus on one part of it. There's, if you go to the website, there's lots more there you can read about. But he makes a really interesting comparison, and that is he compares Trump, Mr. Trump, to Henry VIII, the king. And I have a quote here. This is a quote from the Economist article. The impulsiveness and shallowness of America's president threaten the economy as well as the rule of law. He said, Donald Trump rules over Washington as if he were a king, and the White House his court. His displays of dominance, his need to be the center of attention, and his impetuousness have a whiff of Henry VIII about them, fortified by his belief that his extraordinary route to power is proof of the collective mediocrity of Congress, the bureaucracy, and the media. He attacks any person and any idea standing in his way. So a pretty scathing review. I don't agree with everything they wrote there, but I think if you actually look at Henry VIII's life, there actually are some interesting comparisons.
Yeah, before you get to that, I mean, I hear that and it almost knocks you out of your chair because there may be some truth to that. Where was this guy during the last administration?
Yeah.
Because he is describing that to a T. Unbelievable.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what's interesting, I think we've said this many times, is that how Trump is governing the country is the same way President Obama did. President Obama is the one who changed the presidency. The executive expanded this power and basically made it into a kingship. And every president after, it doesn't matter what side of what party they're on, are going to rule like that. Because that's how President Obama changed the presidency. Because he wanted a Democrat to have that power when he left.
Yeah, and the media wouldn't care if it was, they wouldn't care about any of this if it was a one of their candidates in there. They wouldn't say a thing about it.
Yeah.
And this is not based upon action or fact or anything. It's just partisan to the core.
Yeah, and I think, because I recently I just did some studying into Henry VIII's life, and I think he is, the author is predicating his hypothesis that Henry VIII was a arrogant person who went against the rule of law. That's not true. He was certainly had some vanity, but he wasn't the caricature that this man brings across. And if you actually look at Henry VIII's reign, he reigned in a very divisive time in England when the Reformation hit England. He led the Protestant Reformation, created the Anglican Church, and broke away from Rome. And I think it's interesting to look at what President Trump is doing, because in a way he's reforming politics, and he's breaking away from the conventional liberal mindset that has gripped American politics for decades. And so I think, and in a very divisive America, just like England was divisive between Catholics and Protestants. So I think there actually is an interesting comparison to where Henry VIII went forward with his reforms. Parliament supported him. The government in power supported him. Some of the people didn't. But he went forward with it. And in hindsight, it was one of the key moments in world history when a new kind of government could be formed separate from the Catholic Church, who at that time under the Pope was still trying to conquer nations for himself. That's what the Pope was doing. And I think it's interesting today where Donald Trump he's really reforming politics in America, breaking away from the conventional way of doing things in a very divisive country while you have the GOP supporting him in the government. So I think there are some parallels there between the two and what they're doing, how they do it. Once they have their mind to do something, they're going to do it and overcome all the obstacles. I think there's a comparison there. And if you get through the snarkiness of the quote there, I think there is a little bit of merit to comparing the two, because both were huge reformers in their day, very controversial figures, but also very strong leaders.
And so this writer from The Economist, he pretty clearly doesn't like what the president's doing, because he's saying, well, he's acting like he's a king, which he's not, but again, they've kind of made it that way. But does he give any indication of how he feels, say, about King Henry VIII? Is he didn't like the way he ruled in particular, or does he get into that?
He doesn't get into that very specifically, but I think from what I've read, since he's talking about Donald Trump in a negative way, he's implying that King Henry VIII was a negative, in a negative light as well.
He's sort of a well-known figure, King Henry VIII, and you know, maybe people wouldn't know like a lot of the details, but I think people kind of know who he is, or they would get the gist or the sense of what he's saying. So maybe that's why he picked him, because he is kind of well known, and like you say, he's sort of has a character about him where people think like that he was this very extreme person in a lot of ways, and yeah, maybe to some extent he was, but again, the character isn't exactly who the man was either.
Yeah, that's the problem with popular history, especially the Tudors. That's the most well-read part of British history. Unfortunately, it's a lot people read into like the romance, and they focus a lot on Henry's relationships with his wives.
Right.
That's what most people focus on, but if you actually look at the facts and just at what most of the top historians write about him, there's a lot more to the story, and the thing is they try to portray Henry VIII as some kind of corrupt tyrant who changed England and who was just doing it to get his way because he wanted to divorce one of his Catholic wives because his Protestant mistress gave him a son. That's basically the storyline they give for Henry VIII, and so they're trying to put that narrative on Donald Trump. I think it's just interesting that he chose Henry VIII because a lot of people think he hated women. he's very cruel and that sort of thing. And so it is an interesting name to invoke. And I think it is better than Hitler and Nixon.
Yeah.
compared to what they normally compare Donald Trump to. And if you actually look at the facts, there are some similarities. But I think if people would read history more, they'd realize that, well, you can compare someone to someone in the past, but very rarely is it an exact comparison. There's always differences you have to keep in mind.
Well, the fact that he chose King Henry VIII, I think it does highlight just the way the media thinks and the way they feel about their readers, which is, my guess is the author hasn't studied into it a great deal. He probably has some general knowledge of it and or Googled it, as we're prone to do. And made his, you know, assumptions there. I don't know for sure. But I do think that the author probably thought, well, the readers won't. They'll even if he knew more about, say, King Henry VIII, he probably thought, well, they'll just think of him in this way. I'll make this comparison and then, you know, get my point across. Because I don't think they don't really respect their readers, I don't think. Or I don't know if respect is the right word, but I don't think they think they'll actually investigate. They'll actually of themselves go and say, well, I don't know about this. They feel maybe that they're all powerful and what they say is the truth because they said it. So just the fact that they make these comparisons, whether it's King Henry VIII or like a Hitler or something, I think they're assuming either they're ignorant or they're assuming that their readers are, and it's probably a combination of both.
Yeah. In these kinds of cases, they use people's ignorance against them, or they underestimate the intelligence of their audience. And I think both are the wrong way to go about it. I think it's unethical to do either. But I mean, it's when you compare someone to Hitler, it's always a terrible mistake,
right?
Because no one is close, especially any American leader is not close to Hitler. But if you invoke some other kind of historical perspective, that's fine. Everyone has a right to opinion and everything. But you do have the obligation to do your research to present proof and facts and why you think that is. And most of the proof given here is all predicated on a popular history that is not really true. And so,
and tied together with a current events narrative that also isn't totally true.
Yeah. So you get a double whammy here, yeah. Where, and it's all based on the assumption, and a very negative assumption that both men are dictators, and so they're cut from the same cloth, and that's not true at all. And so it is a little frustrating that not only are they defaming the current president, they're also defaming a historical figure that can't defend themselves.
Right. Well, it would be so fascinating to see what is taught in a journalism ethics class today. That would be fascinating, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
What is your responsibility as a journalist? Tell the truth? Push your agenda, your idea? I would be very interested to see how they would present that material.
Yeah, well, I remember taking it in the journalism class I took. It wasn't very long compared to what you can get at universities and that kind of thing. But they do stress if it's wrong, then you lied.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. And then your credibility is gone as a writer if you're just lying all the time. But that's not true anymore.
No, it's not.
In fact, if you don't lie, your credibility is gone. I mean, just on social media, every day there's bursts of headlines of tweets and all these things, people ripping on the president saying, oh, he's a liar, look at what he did here. Even when the reports come out that they weren't true, like, oh, well, it's still true, or I meant this thing here instead, but it's still true.
Right, it's just that subtlety of, I'm not going to report certain things. I will report other things, and I'll take things out of context.
Yeah.
But then you can always say, well, I didn't lie. But of course it is. It's the spirit of lying. Really interesting. An Economist reporter dishes on Trump's priming the pump interview. That you can read more of that at PRI.com. If you would like to, that's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live, Kia David program, and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Coming up here in just a bit for myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.